Giving a faculty address is something of an intimidating experience, but I had one consolation yesterday, or perhaps a sign. I received a job offer from Presbyterian Ministers Fund to sell insurance. I think many of you, everyone on the list, in fact, got that letter. That may be even more timely since I have chosen the miracles. Not exactly an easy subject to speak on. Much of the contemporary research on the miracle stories of the Gospels reflects its debt to the history of religions research, which flowered at the turn of the century. Scholars like Otto Weinreich and Richard Reitzenstein pursued a massive investigation of the literature contemporary with and external to early Christianity in a search for so-called parallels to the miracles of Jesus. Such parallels were indeed found in abundance, both as to the type of miracle as well as to many of the details of the individual stories. Closely allied with the whole liberal movement of which they were a branch, the underlying quest was for the unique in Christianity, to use Harnack's famous phrase, for the essence of Christianity. By such criteria, the conclusion seemed inevitable. The miracles are not unique, but merely a reflection of the first century world. They are in no way of the essence of Christianity. Well, the heyday of the history of religions is now long past. The falsity of its assumption that there is a necessary relationship of borrowing where parallels exist has been largely discredited. But in many ways, its presence is still felt, particularly in the investigation of the miracle stories. For instance, there has been a recent revival of the old Theos Aner theory, a direct legacy of the history of religion school. Its main features were first delineated by Richard Reitzenstein in two works of 1906 and 1910. Reitzenstein postulated that there was widespread in the ancient world, particularly in the Greek world, a diffused picture of a charismatic miracle-working figure, a man with superhuman abilities. He believed that you found this in all strata of the literature, the different philosophical schools, the different religions of the day. He called this the Theos Aner, the Greek word for divine man, and said that it was this general diffused stereotype that formed the basis for the gospel picture of Jesus with its charismatic features. Reitzenstein's theory was further developed and refined in the subsequent two decades by Weinreich, Hans Windisch, and finally Ludwig Bieler. Bieler is a lesser known name, but he produced the standard work, in fact, the only major attempt to define what in the world we meant by Theos Aner. So I'll take some time in describing Bieler's work. Drawing from many sources, Bieler draws together a composite figure of the Hellenistic miracle-working figure. At the outset of his portrait, he gives the following general description. The divine man is a man with features and faculties which surpass mankind. He is a darling of the gods and a kind of mediator between the divine and man. He then begins his description of this typical Hellenistic divine man using a number of main headings which embrace a variety of standard characteristics, all presented in a more or less stylized, generalized fashion. These include such things as remarkable circumstances at birth, like visitations by a god to the parents, or portents, or traditions of divine parentage. Some account is generally given of schooling, usually emphasizing the prodigious abilities of the hero or the consternation of his teachers. During his life, he appears as a wise man. His words and countenance are described as full of grace. His character is described as one of utmost virtue. His lifestyle is generally ascetic. His knowledge surpasses that of ordinary man. He communicates with animals, has foreknowledge, can see events at far distant places, has power to work miracles, nature responds to his command, demons flee at his word, and men are healed. He generally has disciples and sometimes forms a school. His death is generally as remarkable as his birth. Portents accompany it. Healings are attributed to contact with his corpse, or he is said to simply vanish without any trace of his body ever being found. Beeler's treatment covers some 120 pages, but these examples should suffice to show the main contours of the portrait and its obvious affinities to the gospel picture of Jesus. Beeler's work was completed some 40 years ago, but his concept of theos on air, the Hellenistic divine man, has again come to the fore in recent research, particularly in redaction critical studies of the Gospel of Mark. An increasing number of scholars have used the concept of theos on air in treating the miracle working element in Mark's gospel. In one instance, it is argued that Mark embodies competing Christologies. One is an inferior theos on air Christology, which Mark introduces only to polemicize against and replace with his superior servant Christology. Another work sees Mark as embodying two conflicting types of miracle story. The more original layer comes from a Palestinian setting and is closely related to the teachings of Jesus. The other layer has little connection with the actual Jesus and represents an assimilation to the generalized type of the Hellenistic theos on air. Now, it must be granted that these more recent works employ a more refined methodology and a more sophisticated view of the Hellenistic world than that of former history of religions research. On the other hand, the rubric of theos on air, as such, has not been more carefully defined than in the previous research, and the same weaknesses prevail. Among these weaknesses is the obvious problem of dating. The major sources that Beeler uses for construction of the theos on air type date from the early 3rd century AD and later, that is, if you discount the Gospels. One can see that it is extremely tenuous procedure to argue that a generalized picture of a divine man in the Hellenistic world has influenced the gospel portrait of Jesus, when the earliest traces you find of it really are of the 3rd century and later. Closely allied to this is the diverse nature of the sources. Heavy citation is made of particular philosophical schools among the Greeks, particularly the Neo-Pythagorean school. One almost gets the impression that the theos on air figure is to be found mainly among the Neo-Pythagoreans. Then, extensive citation is made of Christian sources, the early Christian Acts, and the lives of the monks, which date from the 4th and 5th centuries. Again, one wonders if the real line of development is not obviously from the Gospels to this later Christian literature and not by way of some Hellenistic theos on air. In fact, the Jewish literature receives very short shrift, and the Old Testament is assessed as furnishing no real example for the theos on air, a conclusion I find extremely doubtful. I think you've got all the features of the so-called theos on air among various characters of the Old Testament, and that would seem to me like the obvious forebears to any gospel picture of Jesus Christ, the natural Old Testament and Judeo-Christian background there. One could well look at the rabbinic literature and the other Jewish literature for background material to the New Testament miracles, not just for the information it has to give, but also sometimes for the entertainment it has to give. The history of religions men used to love to cite as a so-called parallel to Jesus' raising of the dead a story about Rabbi Judah and Rabbi Zeira. It seems the two rabbis were celebrating the Feast of Purim together. Rabbi Judah became drunk and killed Rabbi Zeira in a drunken stupor. The next morning, when he sobered up and was remorseful, he prayed fervently that God would do something to amend what he had done, whereupon Rabbi Zaira remarkably rose. The next year, Rabbi Judah went knocking at the door of Rabbi Zaira and asked him if he would like to celebrate Purim again. Rabbi Zaira replied, "No, you can't count on a miracle every day." I'm not sure that's a real parallel to the raisings of Jesus. It is a very good illustration of rabbinic humor. A major difficulty with the entire theory is that the theos on air is largely a construct. Recurring features are collected from many sources and then compiled into a composite figure. No single figure reflects all of the features, and many sources lack most of them. Two figures seem to reflect the most traits of this supposed theos on air figure: Jesus and Apollonius of Tyana. Even for Jesus, the portrait of theos on air research is composite, drawn indiscriminately from all four Gospels, and as one would respect, there are many traits of Jesus which do not fit the theos on air type. The same goes for Apollonius. Apollonius was a first century Neopythagorean miracle-working figure and philosopher. Our source for him is a sophist writer by the name of Philostratus, who dates from the 3rd century A.D. Now, Philostratus, in his treatment of Apollonius, describes him in terms commensurate with the theos on air in some places. But in the bulk of his text, the category of philosopher fits him far better. He's just not that much of a miracle worker in the entire portrait that Philostratus gives. It is therefore significant that Gerd Petzka, in his recent study of Apollonius, which is the most exhaustive and carefully worked study we have of Apollonius of Tyana, refuses to employ this term theos on air, and has the following to say about it. "The concept theos on air is certainly freely used but seldom defined, and when it is defined, then it is defined so broadly that all outstanding characters of antiquity can be subsumed under it." In short, the appeal to a generalized Hellenistic theos on air type is too imprecise and tends to gloss over important distinctions. The miracles of Jesus are attributed to his being assimilated to a widespread type of miracle-working figure, and that seems to settle the matter. Further, this sort of treatment tends to be reductionist. The miracle stories tend to be equated with folk tradition or an inferior popular Christology and are virtually eliminated from further consideration. The problem is that the miracles were obviously of central importance to the gospel writers. Mark, for instance, has at least 16 miracle stories by the leanest manner of calculation. In comparison, Philostratus' treatment of Apollonius has only 9. And that work is many times longer than Mark, some 330 chapters to Mark's 16. The miracles were important to Jesus, and important, excuse me, they were important to Mark, I expect to Jesus as well. What did they mean to him and his early Christian contemporaries? This is the important question. It has not been satisfactorily dealt with in much of the contemporary research on the miracle stories. Bogged down in the quest for the historical basis of the miracle stories, the question of meaning and message has been largely overlooked. Now, I would not for a moment want to deny the importance of the historical question, but I would only like to point to another task of the New Testament as of the New Testament historian, as historian. To as best as possible recover the meaning of the miracle stories to the early Christian community that has passed them on to us. I am convinced that the inner dynamic of the miracle stories played a significant role in the history of early Christianity. To uncover that role, I should like to focus attention on 2 related suggestions for research into the meaning of the miracle stories. One involves an old but essential question. What is the individuality of the miracle stories? Their meaning within their own distinctive religious context. The other consideration is primarily methodological, a new, but hopefully not novelistic, manner of uncovering that meaning. First, let us look at the question of the individuality or uniqueness of the gospel miracle stories. This is an essential question. It is precisely the miracle story's non-uniqueness which has led to the negative judgment of so many scholars. Understandably, there have been many attempts to salvage the miracle stories by pointing to their distinctive traits. This isn't a new approach. It goes back to the church fathers, who were often criticized by their pagan opponents, deriding the miracles of Jesus by pointing to parallel miracle traditions in the pagan heroes. In response, the Christian apologist would emphasize such things as that Jesus' miracles had a very long-lasting effect, or that he used no magical devices when he worked his miracles. Sometimes they noted that Jesus took no pay for his miracles, and they often pointed to the superior moral quality of the gospel miracle narratives. Now, there's some truth to this sort of point. Pagan miracle workers were often derided by their contemporaries for their avarice, and some of the miracles of antiquity are notorious by Christian moral standards. For instance, there was a temple of the healing god of Asclepius on the island of Epidaurus in Greece. And on the temple wall are written many stories of the healings that he is supposed to have effected. A woman came to him, for instance, who was barren, and she had a vision in the temple that the god had intercourse with her, and she was cured of her barrenness. By Christian standards, one can see we're in a different world. But at best, this difference is one of degree and balance, not of uniqueness. For there were pagans like Apollonius who refused pay for their work, and the moral standards are high in many of the extra-Christian sources. There is a trap to this sort of approach to uniqueness. It is the old trap of looking for unique details in the miracle narratives. By these standards, uniqueness cannot be established. There are parallels to nearly every detail of the gospel miracles in the ancient literature. This should come as no surprise. It is mere testimony to the fact that the miracle stories belong to the literary and social milieu of the first century. One should expect an affinity with that milieu. On the other hand, there is a significant difference. It is really the most obvious difference, but it has often been overlooked. The gospel miracles are set within the context of the Judeo-Christian religion. They reflect the faith of early Christianity that the power of God had decisively broken into the world in Jesus Christ. That is their primary meaning and testimony. The miracles are through and through eschatological. A number of recent works have noted this distinction. The union of apocalyptic with the working of miracles by a charismatic miracle-working figure like Jesus seems to have been unique to Christianity in the entire history of religions. Scholars such as R.M. Grant insist that the origin of this union of apocalyptic with miracle goes back to Jesus himself. There are significant passages in the Gospels which bear this out, this whole eschatological emphasis. Of major importance are the exorcisms and the sayings associated with them. A central tradition is that of the Beelzebub controversy in Mark 3. You remember the Pharisees accused Jesus of exorcising through the power of Beelzebub, the prince of the demons. Jesus answers them with two parables. One is that of the divided house. A house or kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. In other words, Jesus is saying the exorcisms demonstrate that Satan is being divided, his kingdom is being cleaved in two. His second parable is even more forcible. No one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first bind the strong man. In other words, are stronger than Satan is here in the very fact that his house is being plundered. His kingdom is under attack through the exorcisms of Jesus. At this place, Matthew and Luke insert a saying from their common tradition, a saying which most form critics judge as genuine. If it is by the finger of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. The significance of this saying cannot be overstressed. It testifies to the present dimension in Jesus' message of the kingdom. The kingdom of God is breaking into the world of mankind now. And the exorcisms demonstrate it. The message of the kingdom is bound with the miracle-working activity of Jesus' exorcisms. The two are inseparable. This same dynamic seems to be at work in the sayings of Jesus where he refuses to give a sign. Mark gives an account, you remember, where Jesus flatly refuses to give the Pharisees a sign. Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. The same saying occurs in Matthew and Luke in conjunction with the preaching of Jesus. The only sign for this generation will be the sign of Jonah. The men of Nineveh will arrive at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. Obviously, these sayings could be seen as arguing against the importance of miracles in the early church. No sign will be given. The central matter is the message, the preaching. Actually, they are probably best seen as pointing to the inseparability of miracle from message. The Pharisees do not deny the exorcisms. Rather, they attribute them to Beelzebub. They have missed their meaning. They do not see in them an evidence of the inbreaking kingdom of God. They demand a clearer, more unmistakable sign. But what could that be? Gerhard Dehling has suggested that what the Pharisees demanded was a previously announced sign, a confirmatory sign. Jesus is asked to call upon God for a sign whereby God will confirm and verify that Jesus is working in God's name. It is this sign which Jesus refuses, for then the miracle would be separated from the message and from the response of faith. It would become a condition for the message and bypass the necessity of faith. Further, both miracle and message would then be something under man's control. Man makes a prior demand for a sign from God rather than responding in faith to God's inbreaking eschatological activity. Precisely then, because they are eschatological, the miracles are ambiguous. The Pharisees refuse to accept their eschatological meaning. They deny that they are the activity of God. It is interesting to note that the same attitude prevails in the later literature. The Talmud refers to Jesus as a sorcerer. Justin Martyr refers to Jewish calumnies of his own day, which attributed Jesus' miracles to black magic. Origen's Jewish adversary Celsus claimed that Jesus learned his trade in Egypt and performed only magical arts. In brief, the Jewish response was not a denial that Jesus worked marvels. It was rather that he worked by magical devices or black magic. By the prince of the demons, he casts out demons. Miracles are inseparable from the message. They demonstrate the inbreaking kingdom of God, but only to the one who responds with a confession of faith. In other ways, the gospel writers express their conviction of the eschatological meaning of the miracles. For instance, the miracles are depicted as a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. The classic text here is the one given in Matthew and Luke, where John the Baptist from prison sends a disciple to Jesus to inquire whether he is the coming one or not. You remember that Jesus answers indirectly by pointing to his deeds. The blind see, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor are preached the good news, and blessed is he who takes no offense in me. The words are drawn from Isaiah, chapters 29, 35, and 61. They depict the works of the Messiah. And the point is being made by Jesus pointing to these works that the works of the Messiah are being fulfilled in his ministry. Through the works, which include both preaching and miracle, is to be seen whether he is the coming one or not. But even for John the Baptist, there remains the possibility of taking offense, of stumbling. There is nothing ipso facto about the miracles. Even for John, the necessary response of faith is not bypassed. Each in its own way, Matthew and Luke emphasize this passage. Matthew concentrates an unusual number of miracles of Jesus in the chapters immediately preceding John's question. Every miracle covered in the Isaianic passages are covered and illustrated in these chapters of Matthew. Lame, blind, lepers, deaf, raising of the dead. Luke uses another way of approaching it. He takes one of these Isaianic passages, Isaiah 61, and places it in chapter 4 in a very important part of the gospel, Jesus' programmatic synagogue sermon at Capernaum, a sermon that for Luke points to the whole ministry of Jesus and how it is to be interpreted. In that passage in Isaiah, both preaching and miracle are bound together as works of the Messiah. So for Luke, this text points to Jesus and the proper interpretation of his ministry. He is the Messiah who works miracles and who preaches. In any event, it can be seen that for both Matthew and Luke, the miracles have eschatological significance and are seen as a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. We could go into the individual miracle stories and point out how in the feeding of the 5,000, for instance, and other miracle stories, there is often an eschatological dimension. One could hardly fail to see, as John explicitly sees in his gospel, that the feeding of the 5,000 is a remarkable recapitulation of God's deliverance of the children of Israel and the feeding of the manna in the wilderness. But it would take too much time to look at each miracle story. We have neither the time to do so, nor would that approach go far enough to suit me. For what I should like to demonstrate is that it isn't just a matter of the gospel writers giving an eschatological interpretation to the miracle stories. Rather, within the context of the eschatological conviction of early Christianity, the message of the inbreaking kingdom of God is contained within each individual miracle story. That is, in the very structure of the miracle narratives, the eschatological message is conveyed. To establish this, I will need to move to my next major suggestion, that of a possible new methodological procedure for the investigation of the miracle stories. Let me begin with a disclaimer. I am myself something less than even a novice in the intricacies of the latest structuralist vogue in biblical studies. What little acquaintance I have had with the method has been in introductory level discussions in New Testament colloquium. These discussions have only reinforced my awareness that I still have very much to learn about the method, and I am as yet considerably skeptical of some of the more elaborate claims of the method's more enthusiastic exponents. In spite of this reserve, however, I am increasingly coming to feel that the method offers some real possibilities for recovering the New Testament message when used in conjunction with a more traditional historical critical methodology. This conviction has been reinforced for me by a recent work on the miracle stories of the Gospels by Gerd Thiessen. In his research, Thiessen combines an analysis of the structure of the individual miracle stories with an analysis from a form and redaction critical perspective. Now, the scope of this paper doesn't permit a discussion of Thiessen's entire contribution. I would like to concentrate primarily on his structuralist analysis. To my knowledge, his is the first major work to attempt a study of the miracle narratives from a structuralist perspective. Thiessen's structural analysis is divided into three main chapters. The first chapter deals with the persons or main characters involved in the typical miracle stories of the Gospels. He sees seven of these. There are the person in need, Jesus, the miracle worker. Demons are often present. The people who sometimes, friends and relatives who accompany the sick person, and so forth. There are seven basic characters. All seven occur in only one miracle story in the Gospels, that of the healing of the epileptic boy in Mark 9. But as a good structuralist, Thiessen points out that all seven figures are potential in the structural field of the miracle narrative type. They're potential in every story. This is important redaction critically, for explains why sometimes you'll have another character in a parallel tradition when you compare Matthew and Mark and Luke together. They're potential in the structural field. A second chapter deals with the various motifs or individual details in telling the miracle stories. He outlines 33 of these, and they include such typical things as the approach of the miracle worker, the coming of the sick person and description of his illness, the healing word of Jesus, the acclamation of the crowd, etc. Obviously, all 33 motifs do not occur in any one miracle story, but again, they are potential in the structural field of the miracle narrative genre. Now, Thiessen's third main chapter on structuralism deals with the themes that occur in the miracle stories. He sees six major themes that embrace all the miracles of the Gospels. These include exorcisms, healings, epiphanies, stories of miraculous deliverance, gift miracles. By that he means the feeding of the 5,000, the turning of the water into wine, where a gift is involved, and then what he calls norm-establishing miracles. This latter category is the most intriguing to me, and we'll spend some time on it in a minute. It deals with those controversies that Jesus has with the Pharisees over the law. When all these persons' motifs and themes are put together, Thiessen arrives at a common overarching structure for the entire narrative field. This he describes in terms of the transcendence of boundaries. Each miracle, in one way or another, portrays the crossing over of boundaries and barriers, the transcendence of boundaries. The main character in the miracle story, the person in need, is bound or hemmed in, whether it be by demons, physical illness, the lack of food, the threat of a storm, or death. Jesus, the miracle worker, represents the transcendence of these boundaries. The normal expectancies of human existence are superseded, transcended, in the working of the miracle. Some specific examples might better elucidate Thiessen's analysis. In the story of the woman with the issue of blood, the woman is bound by her physical illness. Luke even describes her as bound by Satan. Her particular malady has acute implications for her whole existence. She is cut off from society and from the cult because she is in a constant state of ritual impurity. She has spent all her money on physicians, and they have failed her. In short, she is at the end of all possible human resources. Her boundaries are clearly drawn. There is but one last glimmer of hope, Jesus, the miracle worker. Even then, human factors tend to hem her in. The crowd pressing around Jesus threatens to prevent access to him. It serves only to reinforce the boundaries which hem her in. But finally she arrives at Jesus, receives the healing touch, and her boundaries are transcended. A less obvious example is Thiessen's treatment of the miracle at Cana. In that instance, the boundaries are economic. The threat imposed by those boundaries is the end of celebration. It is a gift miracle in which Jesus transcends the economic barriers which threaten to end the celebration. This may not seem so obvious in our affluent society. You know, you only need to send somebody down to the corner store to buy some more punch. But not so. Even in our affluent society, it has often been pointed out that depression and crime are strongest at Christmas time. You see, economic barriers are most threatening to the poor in times of celebration. To the poor Galilean father of the bride, one of life's real barriers is transcended. Jesus provides the miracle which transcends the economic barriers and allows the celebration to continue. In some cases, the barrier is set by law. Here we come to one of Thiessen's most intriguing suggestions, his so-called norm-establishing miracles. In this category are involved the miracle stories in which Jesus comes into a conflict with the Pharisees over a Sabbath healing. In this case, the physical illness is still the primary boundary line. But the Sabbath laws enter in as a boundary-maintaining element. They threaten to establish and reinforce the boundaries which keep the man from being physically whole. Just like the woman with the issue of blood, the physicians, with their failure, only reinforce the boundaries of her physical illness. So the law reinforces the boundaries of those who approach Jesus who are sick on the Sabbath day. In transcending the boundaries of the illness, in healing the man, Jesus also transcends the law. He breaks the Sabbath. Thiessen concludes that this type of miracle story must have played an essential role in the radical stance of the Jewish Christian church toward the law. The overcoming of physical barriers in the cure is eschatological. It represents the inbreaking power of God. In turn, the breaking of the barrier through the activity of God in the healing of the man serves to validate the transcendence of the legal barrier of the Sabbath law and establish a higher norm. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. It has sometimes been argued that these Sabbath controversy miracles represent a late stage of development in the gospel tradition in which a miracle story has been introduced to undergird and illustrate a controversy narrative. I would say that the opposite seems to be the case. It is hard to account for the radical stance of early Christianity in regard to the law and the cult without assuming some such dynamic as illustrated in the miracles, which justifies the transcendence of those normal barriers and norms. One could illustrate this out of the rabbinic literature. There is a early second century tradition in the rabbinic literature in which the rabbis are demonstrated a number of miracles by one Rabbi Eliezer. They have been discussing a point of uncleanness, and Rabbi Eliezer is a minority of one. He wants to prove his point so strongly that he works all kind of miracles to undergird it. Makes a carob tree uproot itself, makes a stream reverse itself, and finally calls upon God to give a heavenly voice. And God says, "Don't argue with Rabbi Eliezer, he is right." To all these things, the rabbis turn a deaf ear. They say, "We will not listen to carob trees or look at streams or listen to a voice from heaven, because the law has established the principle of majority rule. It comes from Moses, and it cannot be controverted by any miracle." You cannot contradict or controvert the law by miracle. But the early Christians did. They contravened the law. They transcended the law. They broke the cultic barriers. There must have been some power that allowed this dynamic in early Christianity, and I think Thiessen's theory of the norm-establishing miracles is getting close to the point. It is that eschatological conviction that is illustrated in the miracle stories which lies behind the power of early Christianity, its dynamic in transcending the legal and cultic barriers of its day. Well, I've had to abbreviate somewhat. We're out of time. I could further illustrate this point. The scope of this paper has obviously been limited to one side of the hermeneutic task, to looking at the historical setting of the meaning of the miracle stories in their original context. The other side of the hermeneutical task remains to look at the implications of the miracle message of the first century for our century. How can we communicate the message of the miracles in a meaningful and experiential way to people in our day? This hermeneutic task is not just the task of the New Testament scholar. It belongs to the whole theology faculty. It's a property of the entire church. But this research, I think, perhaps could give us one pointer in one direction. And that is that mankind today still faces barriers as he did in Jesus' day. Often they're the same kind: physical need, economic suppression, racial prejudice. For the early Christians, the miracle tradition dramatized the transcendence of those barriers. The same would seem to apply today. When, in the power of God, the church succeeds in overcoming the boundaries and barriers which threaten the freedom and existence of man, then, in a real sense, she has been true to the New Testament meaning of miracle.